Blog Talk Radio.
Eastern family, what beautiful music Eastern played during its day, and we hope to bring you the sounds of Eastern with each show we broadcast live on the air. Thanks for listening and being part of the radio voice of Eastern Airlines. We've added another broadcast during the week, which you're listening to now, that we hope you like. It's called From the Eastern Files. The program will be dedicated to memories and stories of former Eastern people and news from the new Eastern, as we feel you might want to hear. These broadcasts will usually be only about 1/2 hour in duration and broadcast in the 3 p.m. Eastern Daylight time slot. We may even throw in a music selection or two, but we hope you enjoy our programming during the weekdays at 3 p.m. The program will not be on a regular talk radio format in that we will not take calls. It will be reserved only for Eastern history and news. We will continue to broadcast our regularly scheduled radio live call-in talk show on Mondays, every Monday at 7 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. Now, we hope you like this new addition to the Eastern Radio Show. And let's take time for a commercial break, which, of course, is Eastern Airlines. This instrumental music was recorded for commercials that you can see on YouTube, a beautiful musical arrangement. Now, our story today is a story that unusual story in that it's a passenger who leaped to death from an Eastern Airlines plane. Actually, it was not Eastern Airlines at the time. It was Eastern Air Transport. And the date this happened was exactly 3/3/33, or March 3rd, 1933. It was written, submitted by the late John Engle, who was sales manager for the eastern, southeastern area of Florida, and also station manager in Jacksonville, Florida. And I hope you enjoy John's story that was submitted to the retired Eastern Airlines Pilots magazine. And let's start. Something just happened on my plane that I've never heard before, breathlessly reported arriving Eastern Air Transport pilot George Pomeroy to the manager of the Charleston, South Carolina airport. T.P. Ball, and I bet you haven't either heard this, Mr. Ball. His bet was safe, perhaps. No other U.S. airline pilot, before or after, has been through an experience exactly like this. Certainly, it was a first for Eastern Air Transport on that March 3rd, 1933, as pilot Pomeroy prepared for his approach to the scheduled landing at Charleston en route from Miami to New York. A passenger had just jumped out of the cabin door at an altitude of about 600 feet, some 30 miles south of the airport. The trimotor Stinson Model U was one that was acquired by Eastern Air Transport in purchase of the Ludington line a few weeks earlier and had 10 window seats with the aisle down the middle, the cabin door in the right rear, and a cruise speed of 110 miles per hour. The cabin boasted of no stewardesses, and the pilot boasted no co-pilot. The title of captain on domestic airlines had not yet come into use. The tragedy happened about noon as passengers were still eating box lunches handed them as they had reboarded after a refueling stop at Jacksonville. Charleston police authorities were notified and the flight delayed while the pilot and the remaining six passengers were questioned. One passenger in a rear seat stated that he had heard something behind him and turned just in time to see a passenger's head disappear below the sill of the partially open cabin door before the wind pushed it shut. No passenger doors were locked shut in those early days. Pilot Pomeroy described the locale of the jump as between the Seaboard Railroad Bridge over the Edisto River and the tiny village of Adams Run, a remote area consisting mostly of tidal water and boggy swamps. Airport manager Ball, who also operated the Hawthorne Flying Service at Charleston, and his 20-year-old employee, Beverly E. Bevo Howard, cranked up two Waco F biplanes, one equipped with floats, and took off on an aerial search for the body. A Jacksonville sportsman pilot, W.B. Lamb, in Charleston for a visit, joined in the search with his own plane, also a Waco F, accompanied by Andrew S. McCready, Eastern station manager at Charleston. Results were negative on that first day's search. When the newspaper story appeared the next morning, groups of ground search parties joined both official and volunteer, but the difficult terrain slowed their efforts. Mud covering much of the area could not support an adult's weight. A $50 reward was offered for the person locating the body, a tidy sum in those depression days. The victim and presumed suicide was Merrill B. King, a 45-year-old paper manufacturer from Kalamazoo, Michigan, and president of the Rex Paper Company there. He was returning home via New York following a business trip to Havana. During the intermediate stop at Jacksonville, He had complained to other passengers of a severe headache and also had mentioned recent business reverses. His brother-in-law from Kalamazoo arrived the next day to coordinate and assist in the search and announced a new hire reward of $200. The Kalamazoo American Legion Post wired the Charleston County service officer representing veterans of the World War I that King was an ex-serviceman who was active in American Legion affairs, and this brought out many local Legionnaires as volunteer searchers. A force of seaboard railroad workers also joined in concentrating on and near the railroad right-of-way. Because of negative results the second day, neither the police nor the insurance adjusters were quite ready to accept the missing pilot or passenger as a suicide victim. He had heavy insurance coverage. They quizzed Eastern Air Transport Station Manager McCready. Could he have worn a parachute under his coat, they asked? Could he have hidden in the rear compartment or clung to some low external projection of the plane, such as a tail wheel or horizontal stabilizer rigging until enough to drop off safely just before landing? Andy McCready was patient, but the questions continued. Station agents Lenning Palmer and I were quizzed independently from the station manager. A small part, I recall, handling as an employee of only 4 months' experience with EAL or EAT, was sending a teletype message to the EAT operation manager, Carl H. Dolan, in Atlanta, asking when and where the insurance adjusters could personally inspect that particular Stinson trimotor. It was not exactly or regularly assigned to the run through Charleston, having been operated as a limited stop extra section of the usual Curtis Condor that day only. The fourth day, Pilot Pomeroy returned to Charleston with EAT's Jacksonville-based Florida Superintendent A.P. Kerr to personally participate in the search, and they flew back and forth over the immediate and expanded area for 5 hours. One bizarre aspect crept in. Two woodsmen, a white man and a Negro, together reported seeing a stranger with a mustache and wearing a fur coat walking the railroad bridge near the search area. The press questioned the missing passenger's brother-in-law on this. He explained that King normally was clean-shaven, but that he did own a fur coat. A call to Kalamazoo disclosed that Mr. King had not taken his fur coat to Havana, but instead wore a light gray cloth overcoat and was also wearing both a diamond ring and white gold watch with his initials on the back. After the sixth day, the search was called off, but the reward offer still held. Many months after sportsmen hunters in that area stumbled across the pitiful, sparse remains, consisting mostly of a few bleached bones, perhaps scattered by small animals, clothing tatters, and the initialed watch. This officially closed that case. Now, the following provides a wide sweep of aviation nostalgia as it tracks some of those individually involved and perhaps leads to more violence. First of all, Eastern Air Transport pilot George D. Pomeroy, who was flying the Stinson trimotor from which the passenger jumped, had started his career as the personal pilot of the president and board chairman of the Celotex Corporation, then went into the Ludington line, flying for 2 years on its New York, Washington, every hour on the hour schedules. Although he came to Eastern Air Transport through the Ludington acquisition in 1933, he remained but for 1 year, as the late Captain John Halliburton recalls, that Pomeroy was next persuaded to commence flying a DC-2 for City Service Corporation, which then owned the Miami Biltmore Hotel. Captain John saw him there occasionally and said that he was a very fine pilot and had a wonderful record. Captain George died in 1979. Eastern Air Transport Florida Superintendent A.P. Kerr had flown from Jacksonville to help in the aerial body search. He had been a sergeant in the old Signal Corps of the Army in World War I and was justifiably proud that he had been the first non-commissioned person in the Army to be given flight training and commissioned as a pilot. Throughout the Eastern Air Transport days, he was affectionately known as Pop because his steel gray hair suggested more years than his actual age. He held several executive positions with Eastern during World War II, and he returned to active duty with the Army as commanding officer of the Air Transport Command base at Khartoum in Sudan. Later, he joined the Civil Aeronautics Authority. Eastern Air Transport Operations Manager Carl H. Dolan, who had arranged for insurance adjusters to inspect the Stinson Trimotor, though with Eastern but 3 years, distinguished himself in many phases of aviation. In the first graduating class at MIT to receive a degree in aeronautical engineering, he joined the de Havilland Corporation's in England before World War I. He received his pilot training in the Lafayette Escadrille and was one of 38 Americans who flew dogfights against the German planes before the United States entered the war. He was also one of the only seven of those who lived to see the end of that war and, in fact, proved to be the last surviving member of the Lafayette Escadrille. In 1919, he had returned to de Havilland and was sent to China to head up the creation of a Chinese Air Force. Next, he went to Honolulu to start an inter-island airline. He was then retained by North American Aviation to survey the routes of Pitcairn Aviation and appraise its value. After North American bought Pitcairn, he was made operations manager of Eastern Air Transport and later was promoted to vice president of operations and served until General Motors bought the company. He then became a safety investigator and an advisor to the U.S. Senate, finally settling to a quiet life in Honolulu with his wife, a member of one of the early missionary families there. He was nominated for membership in the Retired Eastern Pilots Association by Captain John Halliburton in 1981 and quickly made a member. This later recognition meant a great deal to him. He died in 1982 at age 86. Now, T.P. Ball, the airport manager for the city of Charleston, had flown out to search for the passenger's body. When Delta extended its routes from Atlanta to Charleston in 1934, he joined Delta as its Charleston station manager. On January 1, 1936, he became a co-pilot in due time a Delta captain. And after World War II service on the staff of General Hap Arnold, then the chief of staff of the Air Corps, he returned to Delta and was made chief pilot. Later, he was promoted to vice president of flight operations. He retired in 1971 and continued to live in College Park near Atlanta. When telephoned about 3333 incident, he found his box of old flight logs and came right up with some direct quotes. And activities he remembered vividly. W.B. Lamb, a yachtsman and a sportsman, pilot and aircraft dealer, with a hangar at Jacksonville's Imeson Municipal Airport since its earliest days, had happened to be in Charleston with his plane and volunteered help in the search of the body. On his return home, it was only natural for him to spread the word around the Jacksonville airport about the passenger's suicide jump near Charleston. It must have made an indelible impression on Jacksonville's Louise, socially prominent, popular, and talented young woman. She started flying in 1931 after she tired of racing speedboats. She was an artist and author of children's books, one with a foreword by Amelia Earhart, and engaged to be married to Gordon Stanton, also a pilot. Jacksonville native Harlow Barnett, later an EAL captain based in Jacksonville, was the best man at that wedding. A month later, Louise's husband was killed in an auto accident, and her grief was more than she could bear. On November 22, 1933, she took up her favorite of the airport's available planes, a new Travelair Sport, gained enough altitude to ensure a fatal crash, and headed east out over the ocean while her gas tank ran dry. She had left in her car at the airport a note to Laura Young, owner of the plane, and attached a check for its full value. No trace of the plane or body was ever found. So respected and admired was Louise Turk Stanton that many Jacksonville pilots flew their planes out to drop flowers at sea as a final tribute during her memorial services. The circumstances of her life and death were so unique and poignant that they later became the foundation of a Hollywood movie. Several years after her death, Jacksonville was the scene of another suicide more directly related to the Charleston incident. Airport agent Lenning Palmer, who had been on duty in the EAT Charleston office in 1933, when pilot Pomeroy landed to announce loss of a passenger, had transferred to the Jacksonville City Ticket Office in May of 1936. Soon after that, he surprised his many friends by leaping from a top floor window of Jacksonville's downtown Greenleaf building to a quick death on a rooftop far below. It was then surmised that, having enjoyed running through an early inheritance left by his South Carolina parents, he had decided that he could not face up to tight budget living on Depression salaries. Beverly E. Bevo Howard, the Hawthorne Flying Service pilot in Charleston, who had helped in the actual search for the body in 1933, was a native of Augusta, Georgia, and had received his early flight instruction from two future Eastern stalwart captains, Fred Dorsett and Mac Johnson, and soloed at an age of 16 before joining Hawthorne Flying Service in Charleston in 1932. 14 months after that aerial search for the body, he had a most agonizing experience. He flew Al Luke, a prominent Charleston executive, who was also his close personal friend, to Washington, D.C. And Al had been closely interested in the 1933 passenger suicide and search. In fact, had discussed it with Bevo at the time. Returning from Washington, May 31st, 1934, in the Travelair 4000, bought from Eastern's vice president, the late Sid Shannon, and just south of Petersburg, Virginia, Al suddenly released his seatbelt and stood up in the Ford cockpit. Bevo throttled back, shouted, and grabbed for his arm, but his efforts were not being heeded. So Bevo reached for a heavy fire extinguisher to overpower him. Before he could wield it, Al had jumped clear of the plane and to certain death. Later that year of 1934, Bevo joined Eastern as a transportation agent, and by 1935, at age of 21, became Eastern's youngest co-pilot. He was based at Newark and flew for several months before coming to the conclusion that what he called straight and level flying was not for him. So on January 1st, 1936, when Preble became Delta co-pilot and left Charleston, Bevo returned to Hawthorne Flying Service in Charleston as its president. Soon he established a branch operation in Mobile and was a World War II approached. And as World War II approached, he contracted to operate a number of civilian pilot training schools throughout the South to provide pilots with some basic flight training for the Army Air Corps to draw upon. By war's end, Hawthorne had trained over 6,000 pilots, including 2,000 cadets for the French government. Bevo then felt free to indulge his first love, acrobatics competition, and became the international acrobatic champion in 1946, 1947, and 1949. He purchased the famed Hungmaster aerobatics plane that had been built in Germany and air freighted to the U.S. via the Hindenburg in 1936. Bevo performed in and won competitions in many countries. His specialty was a low pass in front of the stands, plane inverted and with both arms visibly hanging down toward the ground, while his vertical stabilizer clipped a ribbon stretched between two 20-foot poles. On October 17, 1971, he put on a charity performance in Greenville, North Carolina, to benefit the Greenville Boys Club and, as usual, thrill the crowd. As always, he had minimized the fuel in his tank to maximize nimbleness on the controls. And as he was completing the show, his tank ran dry when turning in to his spectacular inverted pass in front of the stands at only 50 feet over the runway and was too low to recover, resulting in a tragic and fatal crash before all spectators. His plane did not burn, so it was able to be rebuilt for the National Air and Space Museum in Washington, D.C., where you can now see it hanging with its vivid striping and air show colors. In standing alongside his airplane displayed there, if you cannot read his name painted near the cockpit, it is because the lettering, like the airplane, is upside down. Having known Bevo well enough to barnstorm with him as his ticket seller for hops, I am positive this is the way he would have wanted it to be displayed. And the story was written by John Engel, who also was in the search party, day, March 3rd, 1933. That's our story for this from the Eastern Files. We hope you enjoyed it. And just to complete our show today, we hope that you have enjoyed this great Eastern story selected from the Eastern Files for today's broadcast. If you'd like to contribute a story of your own from your Eastern days and in your own voice, or to be read better than the story that was read today on the broadcast, please give us an email and shoot us an email, and we will show you how simple it is to tell your story on From the Eastern Files. Send your thoughts about this, and we'll get right back to you. Just email us at host@ealradioshow.com. We really want you to be part of the radio show. We want to hear more stories like John Engel's story about the passenger who leaped from an Eastern airplane. And so we close out our show by a beautiful song rendered by none other than John Denver. And until next week, and another broadcast
all my bags are packed.
From the files
go,
of Eastern, the Eastern files. We say now, so long, Eastern family. Enjoy this song,
goodbye.
And we'll see you next week. We love you, Eastern.
But the dawn is breaking, it's early morn. The taxi's waiting, he's blown his horn. Already I'm so lonesome I could die. So kiss me and smile for me. Tell me that you'll wait for me. Hold me like you'll never let me go. 'Cause I'm leaving on a jet plane. Don't know when I'll be back. Babe, I hate to go. There's so many times I've let you down, so many times I've played around. I tell you now, they don't mean a thing. Every place I go, I'll think of you. Every song I sing, I'll sing for you. When I come back, I'll bring your wedding ring. So kiss me and smile for me. Tell me that you'll wait for me. Hold me like you'll never let me go. Go. Now the time has come to leave you. One more time, let me kiss you. Then close your eyes and I'll be on my way. Dream about the days to come when I won't have to leave alone. About the times I won't have to say. Kiss me and smile for me. Tell me that you'll wait for me. Hold me like you'll never let me go. 'Cause I'm leaving on a jet plane. Don't know when I'll be back. I hate to go. I'm leaving on a jet plane. Don't know when I'll be back again. Oh, babe, I hate to go.